Hi everyone, and welcome to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and you might notice the amazing sound quality today, and that's because we're in the Audioboom studio recording today, but please don't get used to it. I don't think we can be here every day, but yeah, enjoy it while it lasts. For today, I am with Warren, actually, to get a bit transatlantic and talk about America's presidential election. There have been a lot of parallels drawn between the election there and the EU referendum, and more specifically between Trump and the Vote Leave campaign. That's why, for this episode, we chatted to Dr. Jacob Perikilis, a researcher and assistant head of the US and Americas program at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House. What a mouthful. We touch on similarities in core messaging, voter demographic, and accusations of voter fraud, as well as on how likely it is that Trump will pull off a Brexit-style surprise win. So stay tuned for the rest of the episode and get yourself ready for a turbulent couple of days. If you want to make sense of all the nonsense, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll get all our upcoming episodes sent straight to your phone. If you enjoy the show, please also review us, as that's how people, you know, find out about us, and it really helps us out. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Jacob Perikilis. To start off with, just a little question about you. You are the assistant head of the US and Americas program at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House. Can you explain what exactly that is and what your job there entails?
Chatham House is an international think tank founded in the early part of the 20th century in the wake of the First World War to try to promote international cooperation and understanding. We have a range of research programs focusing on both thematic and regional areas. The U.S. and the Americas program specifically looks at the global role of the U.S. and how it interacts with the rest of the world. So in the assistant head role, I manage some of our research programs. I do some of my own research on a variety of topics around U.S. global positioning and U.S. global engagements. And I do things like podcasts and media and public appearances.
So with a role like that, it would seem like, what will we be looking at specifically for Brexit? I mean, there's a number of angles we could go down. What about the UK's relationship with the U.S.? How's that going to unfold? But I think the big thing that we wanted to start looking at was parallels, if you see them, between the way Donald Trump is garnering support and the way the Leave campaign garnered support. Do you see any particular crossover in the techniques used by either of those sides?
I think there's absolutely some parallels, and they've definitely been played up explicitly both by Trump and by Nigel Farage. Boris Johnson has been somewhat less keen to play that up because he and Trump have a more adversarial relationship. But they are definitely both sort of manifestations of resistance to the establishment. They both sort of play on a set of fears about globalization, particularly immigration and increasing multiculturalism. I think a lot of the similarities are overplayed, though. There's a lot of speculation, especially in the sort of transatlantic elite, that because Brexit happened, Trump became more likely. And I don't buy that. I think the two are independent of each other. To be clear, you know, President Trump may or may not happen, but I don't think that if he does happen, it'll be because Brexit happened. I don't think it's part of a sort of a linked phenomenon necessarily, or at least not fundamentally. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, Brexit is a very different change in Britain's relationship than Trump would be. I mean, it's splitting off from the European Union, whereas Trump is he's a person. He would be a president. He would institute a series of policies, and that drives voter behavior. It's much easier to sort of convince yourself that you're voting for a policy, regardless of what you think of the people advocating for that policy, than to vote for somebody who you may see as unfit. I think that's a harder leap. The other issue is fundamentally demographics. The U.S. is a much more diverse country, and Trump has not done well, even by the standards of modern Republican presidential candidates, in polls amongst ethnic groups other than white people, essentially, or with women, frankly. And that's a much bigger slice of the electorate. So you're talking about a much more sort of hostile environment for him to succeed in. Again, none of this means that he won't win, but it does mean that he has a bigger mountain to climb than I think the Leave vote did.
Would you say, though, that sort of
the demographics that they're both appealing to are quite similar, as in maybe older, white, working class people?
Older and whiter, certainly. Working class is a bit more contentious. I mean, there's been this idea in the US that Trump is the sort of manifestation of white working class rage at the establishment. And while there's certainly some truth to that, a lot of the demographics of his supporters in terms of income, in terms of job, in terms of sort of social position are not what you'd expect. He has a lot more support amongst educated, relatively well-to-do sort of middle to upper middle class people than that stereotype of Trump just being for sort of for poor rural people would suggest.
Now, for the looking at the Brexit vote, one of the sort of a common line in the media or the narrative has been, you know, it was a protest vote. It wasn't necessarily for Brexit. It was a protest vote. And we have found it harder than we would expect to find people representing that view. I'm not saying they're not out there, but it's been harder to find them. You know, who can we get to explain that? Do you think it's just a convenient way of labelling it? And do you think people would do the same thing, saying that a Trump vote is a protest vote? If people are saying that, is there substance behind it? Or is it just a convenient tag?
I think there is a little bit of substance behind it. One of the other differences is that Brexit was a cross-party phenomenon. You had Tories who voted for it, you had Labour members who voted for it, you had people voting for it from the left and the right in sort of broad ideological terms. Trump is much more a Republican manifestation, despite the sort of claims that he'll expand the map, that he'll reach out to Bernie Sanders supporters. I don't think any of the polling or any of the early voting statistics have backed that up. He's performing very similarly to Mitt Romney in 2012, who, you know, at least on the surface, had a very conventional Republican appeal, whereas Trump arguably doesn't. So the way that manifests itself, the way the sort of the question of is this a protest vote, it comes through very differently when you're talking about something which is fundamentally the leadership of a political party rather than just a single referendum on a single issue, which can be supported without any sort of hesitation by people of any political party.
Something I found quite striking in a way is that both Trump and prominent Brexit campaigners at the time warned their supporters of the election or the referendum potentially being rigged against them. What do you think that says about the general confidence in the in these democratic political systems and sort of, yeah, of just the, I don't know, the democratic feeling of people if they're ready to sort of discard a vote that might be against them as unfounded straight off the bat?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a sign that the strength of democratic institutions and the trust of a large portion of the populace in democratic institutions is eroding. And I wish I had a sort of glib, easy answer and a sort of confident solution of how to fix that, but I don't. I mean, I think there is across the US and the UK a shared sense that democratic institutions have become sort of corroded, that they need to be refreshed or replaced. And that's manifested in not only the lack of trust, but the sort of media machine that's been built up. And this is, I mean, in both of these cases, this is primarily a right-wing phenomenon, but it's by no means limited to the right wing. And in some ways, it's sort of outside of traditional ideological spectrums. That, you know, the sense that we shouldn't be listening to The Guardian or The Times or The New York Times or ABC News. We should be listening to alternative news sources, whether that's WikiLeaks or RT or something else. And those last two are increasingly indistinguishable. But I mean, the point is more that there are sources of information that don't cohere to one established ideological camp or the other, which have increasing reach, not necessarily in terms of actually setting a policy agenda, but in sowing seeds of doubt and sort of laying the groundwork for people to just disbelieve anything that established sources are telling them simply on the grounds that they're established.
That's an interesting point, because it seemed with Brexit certainly crystallized in the UK, an increased divorcing of actual truth from campaigning on both sides. Do you think, and certainly that case could be leveled against the Trump and Clinton debates and things that are going on now, do you think there is an increase in sensationalism and the things that people will be prepared to say and then turn back on later when elected or when things have happened across politics in general? Or are we just looking at it on too small a scale? Has that always happened?
There is this increasing sort of consensus around the idea of post-truth politics. And certainly, I mean, Trump in particular, and we really have to set Trump aside here because the extent to which he says things that just aren't in any way connected to reality is widely, wildly out of proportion to any... I mean, all politicians lie, right? All politicians at some point or another tailor their message to their audience and maybe tweak the truth a little bit and tell stories that are maybe exaggerated a little bit to and, you know, some politicians do it a bit more aggressively than others. But Trump is in a completely different category. He, you know, he says things like Obama founded ISIS. And when challenged by a friendly interviewer to sort of walk it back, he said, no, I literally mean Obama founded ISIS, which is just... you know, it's so far outside of the realm of truth that it boggles the imagination. And then, you know, that particular one, he eventually said, "Oh, I was being sarcastic," which also boggles the sense of what sarcasm is. I mean, you have this sense that, you know, if you sort of push the boundary far enough, the boundary sort of comes along. And I have been analogizing this entire election season to those old Warner Brothers cartoons where one of the characters will run out over the edge of the cliff and they just keep running until they look down. And that's when they fall. And I think the thing that Trump has figured out, which I suspect he's not the first to figure out and I suspect he won't be the last either, is that if you never look down, if you never admit fault or that, you know, you could possibly mistake it, you can run an awfully long way before the ground rises up to meet you.
That's a great analogy. And let's just say that Donald Trump, with his running and his not looking down and his Obama-founded ISIS and absolutely wild suggestions like that, let's call him 10 out of 10 on the scale of that type of approach. Where would you put the Leave and Remain campaigns on a scale of 10, with Donald Trump being 10 there, in terms of how far they pushed things?
I mean, I should say that my primary research specialty is the U.S. I mean, I comment on the U.K. in the sense of the transatlantic relationship and sort of and of course of living here. So with that caveat, I mean, I think the Leave campaign certainly had a few significant deviations from the truth. The famous £350 million a week claim, that they would spend that money on the NHS. I think, you know, my sense was that a lot of the sort of rhetoric used by those campaigns was more in sort of very aggressive omission, whereas with Trump's lines, it's much more about commission, that he says things that actively aren't true, that he sort of pursues lines of inquiry that, you know, have long been closed by most people. For instance, Obama's birth certificate, that was, you know, he was the most visible proponent of that, and he didn't give it up until about 2 months ago.
So coming a little bit to, I suppose, the phrasing of very specific slogans, which, of course, Trump is famous for, his sloganization of basically everything. So his is, of course, America First, as everybody knows. And then that sounds so similar to me to the Vote Leaves, Take Back Control, and then Nigel Farage's celebration of the UK's Independence Day. So to me personally, this is an opinion. I should add this so that everyone knows this is my opinion. It always sounded a bit like it. I felt like it appealed to people because it's this sort of last holding on to this homeland, this white homeland that they might have already lost to globalization. Does that ring true to you as well?
There is, I mean, you can look at this through a frame of sort of nationalistic rhetoric, and I think there's a real similarity there between the kinds of framing that Farage used and the kinds of framing that Trump uses in terms of restoring the great, you know, make America great again is a pretty explicitly nationalistic slogan. It's, you know, we used to be great. And the thing about Trump is he's been saying this since the late 1980s, probably longer than that. But, you know, Reagan didn't make America great again. Bush didn't make America great again. Clinton didn't make America great again. It's not a reference to a specific point in time or a specific status, at least as far as sort of Trump, you know, within Trump's life. What he's saying is, you know, it's basically an appeal to people who feel that sort of sense of loss, that sense of cultural change, that there was an imaginary past where everything was great. And I think you do see parallels of that here. The idea that, you know, Britain will go back to a sort of 19th century relationship with the world. I mean, it elides a lot of detail. It elides a lot of complexity, both moral and otherwise. And I think it basically, you know, is an emotional appeal rather than a sort of fact-based appeal.
And if we're looking at the ever popular topic of polls, of course, Clinton was doing quite well there for a while, what with the Access Hollywood tape and the sexual assault allegations and everything. She was doing okay. But then, of course, the gift that keeps on giving, her email server, popped up once again. And then, of course, she has slumped from, it was a 4.6 lead for a while, and it's now 2.5, or it was on Halloween. And then one poll by ABC News and the Washington Post even said that Trump was leading for the first time in the entire election. I think that was November 1st. And then the polling predictions for the EU referendum were sort of similar in a way, I think, or at least it appears that they are. So YouGov and Ipsos Mori both predicted just about 52 to 48 win for Remain, and we all know how that ended up turning out. And people are attributing it a lot, I think, to the fact that the polls underestimated the turnout of older and less educated voters from the Northeast and things like that. So of course, that's what Trump has been building on when he calls himself Mr. Brexit, right? So he's assuming that he too can mobilize those non-voters. And I know that you already said that you don't think he'll pull off a Brexit because you don't think it's that comparable, but can I get your take on that?
So, I mean, the proof will come in 6 days from this recording. I mean, the we don't know is the caveat that we should always use when we're talking about polling and predictions. That said, British pollsters and the American pollsters like Nate Silver, who sort of came over here and tried to poll the electorate, missed the composition of the electorate here, because I think there wasn't a good point of comparison. No one knew what the national referendum electorate would look like because there hadn't been one in decades. So you're basing it on essentially national elections, but those are a very different question, and it drives a very different electorate. And fundamentally, the question is very simple, but the issue is very complicated. So I think pollsters struggled with that, and you saw that in the results. But what they didn't, it was a miss in terms of the ultimate result. It wasn't a massive miss in terms of the margin, as you pointed out. I would say for U.S. polling, there's a lot more of it. It's done by a much wider range of organizations, and it's organizations that have a much longer record of polling precisely this electorate. The American general election electorate is pretty well known. And on the whole, I mean, you know, okay, yes, we can say that Donald Trump is a unique factor, but we already have a comparative set, which is the primary elections. And on the whole, with one or two exceptions, the polls were fairly predictive of Trump's margins in the primary elections. And if anything, they overstated his support a little bit. The other thing to say is with polling, you know, there are various things that polling doesn't capture. It doesn't capture the extent to which a campaign is organized and capable of turning out its supporters. And this is not, again, my area of expertise, but my feeling was that the Leave and Remain camps were relatively equally organized. They sort of canceled each other out in terms of get out the vote and sort of operational side, whereas there's no sense that the same is true for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Clinton has a very modern, very professional campaign. It's very heavily staffed. It's very well funded. Trump has run a more sort of ad hoc organization. He has decried the use of data and targeting. He's claimed that, you know, his rallies are sufficient to bring people out. So on the day of the election itself, there's going to be significantly more effort put by Hillary Clinton's campaign into actually bringing people to the polls and physically voting. And, you know, and that's true. The voting is already underway, I should say. I mean, it has been for about a month now. And the Clinton campaign has been turning out people fairly successfully for that. So, you know, there's that effect. There's also the possibility that the demographics that the polls are missing are demographics that support Hillary Clinton. One of the big issues in the Brexit campaign was whether pollsters were reaching voters who only had mobile phones. And so those voters, you know, I think in both cases, would largely be younger people. They would largely be people who would support Remain, just demographically speaking, and people who would support Hillary Clinton. So there are a lot of caveats, and I think the assumption has been that any unknown favors Trump. I don't think that's the case at all. I think there's, you know, the unknowns are, to borrow a phrase from Donald Rumsfeld, unknown. You know, we know, or maybe some of them are known. We know that Trump's campaign won't have as good a ground game as Hillary Clinton's, but we don't know how much of an effect that'll have on the day.
It's an interesting point you make about how when you're looking at the sort of the lie of the land in American politics at the moment, you have a lot of comparable data to look at, and you're kind of dealing with a lot of constant patterns. Whereas when it came to polling a referendum electorate in the UK, well, there wasn't much basis, there wasn't much data to go on, so it was more of a shot in the dark. Similarly, as we now move into the Brexit landscape, that is also a shot in the dark, which is kind of one of the big reasons this podcast exists. And in terms of putting a crystal ball on UK-American relations and trade and things going forward, what are the key benefits, negatives, or just the key points that you see that lie ahead for the UK with its in its relationship with the US and vice versa?
So the big one that comes to mind immediately is whether the UK and the US will be able to agree a bilateral trade agreement. And that'll depend a lot on who becomes the president, because Clinton is much less sort of instinctively anti-free trade agreement than Trump. She has backed away from supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but there's no reason why she couldn't begin to negotiate new bilaterals, especially with countries like the UK, which have a very comparable sort of human development index. There's no sense that exploited British workers are going to be building, you know, cheap products for Americans that activists can kind of latch onto as a reason to oppose them. So I think that one sort of politically is relatively easy, but the question is whether she wants to spend political capital. I think in terms of defense cooperation, there's a big question, because the US has long relied on the UK as a partner for defense and particularly intelligence cooperation. I don't see the intelligence cooperation aspect changing. I think that is it's a very strong relationship, and it's seen as beneficial to both countries by both countries. No one really wants to mess with that. On defense, it really depends. I mean, a President Trump will probably be interested in withdrawing American forces from a large portion of Europe. He may or may not include the UK. So, you know, whether U.S. Air Force planes are still stationed at RAF Lakenheath might be on the table. I don't know for sure. But certainly Trump has indicated that he doesn't believe that American alliance relationships as currently structured benefit the U.S. And I don't think a call to Whitehall from the Trump Pentagon saying you owe us $10 billion a year to continue stationing Air Force jets on your territory would be met with a particularly fond or considered response. I think that could be a potential issue there. I mean, beyond that, it really does depend on geopolitics, because the US and the UK have largely seen eye to eye on the big geopolitical issues of the day. But if a President Trump were to, you know, throw the American relationship with Russia, for example, into a completely different direction, if he comes in as he's sort of promised to do, to do his own reset with Putin, I think that would be a pretty strong break from British foreign policy preferences, not to mention those of other European states. And that could lead to a pretty major split.
Just to go back to trade for one second, as you just mentioned, obviously Trump is very openly anti-free trade deals, but then he's also said, as sort of a result of Brexit, and I think to appear as sort of an opposite to Obama, who obviously said that Britain, if we voted to leave, would sort of be at the end of the line when it came to trade deals, he, I think, just to be contrarian, said no, Britain wouldn't be last in line. Where do you think, obviously, I mean, he's the king of opposing views, so it's not that surprising that he differs there, but where do you think his actual, well, I don't even know if I can ask you what his actual opinions are, because I suppose nobody really knows. I don't even think he knows, but
well, we don't know who his Secretary of State would be. We don't know who his Secretary of Commerce would be. I mean, the most optimistic, if you're looking at this from a sort of pro-transatlanticist perspective, the most optimistic outcome would be that Trump offshores, if you will, most of the foreign policy to Mike Pence and to a relatively conventional establishment-minded Secretary of State, someone like I don't know, Richard Haass from the Council on Foreign Relations, somebody like that, just sort of, you know, throwing a stab in the dark at somebody who hasn't sort of signed one of the declaiming Trump from the foreign policy perspective letters, that they would then basically prioritize that and get Trump to sign off on it just out of sort of lack of interest or focusing his own attention elsewhere. I don't know how likely a scenario that is. I think more likely there would be people within the administration, most likely sort of the not the political appointees, but the career people who focused on this for a long time, who might try to advance it, and it would end up sort of stalled on the desk of a political appointee who's been given the remit to bring manufacturing jobs home rather than build up free trade agreements abroad.
And in terms of the looking a bit further ahead on the business side of things, I mean, Trump as a businessman himself, I would have thought that naturally would have made him pro-free trade and open markets. But as Jen mentioned earlier, he has these contrarian points of view. Any idea which one you think's the real one?
He's also not in a business that where free trade is a real issue. I mean, he's in, to the extent that he's in business anymore, it's branding. It's basically, you know, getting his name on buildings and condo, you know, golf courses and condo buildings and that sort of thing. By way of getting the Trump brand out there. I mean, to some extent, he's still involved in construction, and there are some free trade issues around movement of labor and movement of components. But, I mean, he's not, you know, he's in a very sort of traditional business, or he came up in a very traditional business, and I think doesn't automatically see free trade as beneficial. Of course it is. I mean, you know, who's going to buy those high-end luxury goods? You know, who's going to buy Trump-branded products? And of course, many of his own branded products are made in China. So there's a level at which I think he is confused or sort of speaking in political terms that don't necessarily benefit him in business terms. But I think the larger factor is he sees this as a tremendously beneficial political position to take. And I don't think, given his success in the primary, that we can necessarily argue with that. I don't have a good sense of how that would actually play out. I do know that his promises to sort of turn his business over to a blind trust have basically come down to, oh, I'll let my kids run my business. But he would still be hugely invested in it. We don't know how much because we haven't seen his tax returns. But, you know, he would still have potentially significant clashes between his business interest and the national interest of the United States.
And for the election that's almost on us now, do you think a President Trump or a President Clinton is one or the other is better for the UK? And do you think that has been changed by Brexit? You know, does the Brexit landscape now make one or the other better for us, or does it not make much difference? What do you think of that?
I think Clinton is more dedicated to the idea of the transatlantic relationship and the sort of traditional ties that have bound the United States and the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe. I think in terms of predictability, if you're concerned about sort of short-term impacts, predictability, you know, stability of markets, I think you would probably say that Clinton would be a better choice. I mean, the difficulty with Trump is that he's deeply, deeply unpredictable. So I struggle to come up with a scenario where Trump's presidency would benefit the United Kingdom or the transatlantic relationship directly. But, you know, the world is a very complicated and almost unknowable place sometimes.
There's a lot of unknowns going around right now.
Speaking of unknowns, actually, I want to touch on the economy for just a second. In the wake of the EU referendum, an article in The Economist stated, or sort of attributed, the plunge of the sterling to Britain turning into a xenophobic, interventionist, and unpredictable place. And to me, that sounds a lot like Trump's policy agenda. So I'm curious how you think a Trump win might affect the dollar, or whether it would at all.
every time it used to be that when Trump's polls went up, the peso would go down. It's now affecting the dollar directly. So I think the immediate impact on markets, especially given that Trump has said things like, oh, I'd renegotiate American debt, which questions the full faith and credit of the United States. Markets clearly are not convinced by the prospect of President Trump. I think you would see a short-term shock. I think there are some businesses that would benefit under Trump, but I think on the whole, you know, between his sort of unpredictability, his willingness to question fundamental economic issues, and the fact that his economic plans, such as they are, haven't really explained how they would sort of accomplish the goals that he sets out. They haven't set out how he would keep his policies deficit neutral or to sort of pay for the significant expansion in, you know, wall building for one thing that he's talked about, because, you know, Mexico is not actually going to pay for the wall. So, I mean, I think there are some really unanswered questions there. And it's difficult to say that, you know, he would lead to an immediate sort of boost to the economy.
Okay. Well, I think I know that you've got to be gone shortly. And thanks so much for making the time to be with us today. I think just one last takeaway, if we could leave it for people. In the Brexit landscape that Britain finds itself in now, if people only took one thing away from this point in terms of future relations with America and what may, you know, a President Trump or a President Clinton may mean for that, what would be the biggest thing you think people ought to be thinking about or at least aware of?
I think the thing to be aware of is that Trump may or may not win on Tuesday, but I think he's demonstrated that a sort of nationalistic, more inward-facing American foreign policy is a real thing. And I don't think you can expect that the Republican Party in particular is going to snap back to a sort of interventionist, internationalist mood after Tuesday, even if Trump loses by a considerable margin.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for sticking around, and since you've sat through this whole podcast, I bet you want to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your fix. If you want to leave any comments, complaints, or suggestions for future guests, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at brexitpodcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod. Or MacLeod, I'm not exactly sure, but we'll go with it.